Welcome. This is Creating a Family. Talk about foster, adoptive, and kinship care. Welcome back to all of our regulars and a special welcome to you newbies. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am the host of this show as well as the director of creatingafamily.org. Today, we're going to be talking about predicting and coping with failed adoption matches. This is a really important topic. It happens more often than especially, I think, prospective adoptive parents going into an adoption realize. We're going to be giving you lots of information about it. So hang around and stay to the end. We'll be giving you some tips for coping with it. We will be talking today with Lila Bradley. She is a partner with Claiborne, Fox, Bradley & Goldman, LLC in Atlanta, Georgia. She has practiced law relating to adoption and child welfare for the past 20 years. She was the former director of the Atlanta Volunteer Lawyers Foundation's Children's Law Program, where she worked with volunteer lawyers to provide pro bono legal representation for children who were in foster care or were the subjects of high conflict custody disputes. To bring attention to the rights and needs of children, she authored the publication Family Preservation in Georgia, a Legal Guide to Preventing Unnecessary Removal to State Custody. Welcome, Lila, to Creating a Family.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
As I mentioned, this is an important topic, but I want to make a distinction at the beginning to help everybody know what we are talking about. And that is, we're talking about matches that don't work out. We're going to be spending most of our time together today talking about domestic infant adoption. But we're also going to be talking about foster care adoption and international adoption towards the end. A failed match is different from an adoption dissolution, or sometimes known as an adoption disruption. That happens after the adoption is finalized. A failed match happens prior to finalization. So maybe to make this a little easier for everybody to understand, can you talk to us about what is the, and I'm going to put air quotes around the word typical because I realize that when we're talking adoption, very little is typical. But anyway, what is the typical process for domestic infant adoption, whether the adoptive parents are using an adoption agency or an adoption attorney?
Sure. So you're right. Of course, it's hard to talk about typical, but we can identify a couple of phases that virtually every adoption goes through, recognizing that adoption law is a state law, so it's different depending on what state you're in.
And that drives people crazy.
It does.
There are more than 50 because we've got other territories. So,
exactly.
And then the DC. Each of them have their own law, and not a single one of them is identical.
That is exactly right. And not infrequently, adoptive parents, hopeful adoptive parents, are dealing with two state laws because perhaps they live in one state and the expectant mother lives in another state. Mm-hmm. I think of adoption process in phases or stages. And so the first stage is the match when the expectant mother has chosen the prospective adoptive parents. You know, expectant mother and possibly the biological father, those individuals who are going to have the legal rights to this child when born, when they make that decision of who they want to place the child with, and when those prospective hopeful adoptive parents have agreed, this is the person we want to make an adoption plan with. So we're going to call that the match. That proceeds to then the birth of the child, because in most cases, that surrender of parental rights, where the parents with legal rights to the child sign the documents to surrender those rights and consent to the adoption, that happens following birth. So you've got the match initiated, then the adoption plan progresses until the birth, then the documents are signed or the parents appear in court. Some states require a court appearance to surrender rights. Then it proceeds to adoption finalization, which, again, depending on the state, could be 2 months following birth. It could be 6 months following birth or a year, just depending on what's going on with that adoption plan and what the state laws are.
The baby is living with the adoptive parents during this period of time.
In most cases, yes. What you would expect in a typical private, meaning not involving the state agency, infant adoption, the child is placed following delivery and is living with the adoptive parents through that initial surrender phase proceeding to finalization.
Is there any state that you know of that allows a birth parent or an expectant parent, but in this case, they're planning on placing a child, does it allow any to relinquish their parental rights prior to birth?
There are several states. My state, Georgia, is one where an unmarried father can effectively surrender rights and consent to adoption before this child is born. But to the best of my knowledge, there are no states that permit a final surrender of rights from the mother until following delivery.
Thank goodness. You know, that would be so wrong. So, okay, good. That's as far as I know, I would agree. I've never heard of one. That's why I was asking.
Right.
When can a mom change her mind and decide, I'm changing my mind. I don't want to place this child. I want to parent.
Sadly, for everybody, those decisions can be made and people can change their minds. Essentially, at any point from the initial match up until that surrender of rights, when she is signing documents or appearing before court, depending on the state, she can always change her mind up until that point. Then state laws differ significantly on how long she has from the point in time when she has signed those documents. How long does she have to revoke that surrender consent? In the state of Georgia, our revocation period is 4 days. Although if the fourth day falls on a weekend or a holiday, it goes to the following day. So if, you know, if she has surrendered on the Wednesday before the Labor Day weekend, then her revocation period is going to extend until that Tuesday after Labor Day.
That's a relatively small, I mean, other states have a longer period of time.
Yes, I know of states that have revocation periods up to 30 days. There might be some that are even longer. Now, there are also states that provide that she cannot sign until a certain waiting period after mm-hmm. birth, maybe 2 or 3 days, and then it's non-revocable. Mm-hmm. And then in other states, that surrender or consent to adoption is done in front of a judge, in which case it is then non-revocable.
Got it. Okay.
Now, there is a resource that I always point people to.
Please, yes.
The Children's Bureau. Our Department of Health and Human Services has an agency called the Children's Bureau, and you can find it online if you just Google Children's Bureau.
And we'll also include the link in the show notes.
Yeah, it is a wealth of information on the laws around the country. And so there's a page that goes state by state to tell you when can birth parents sign and how long do they have to revoke.
Gotcha. I agree with you. It's a wonderful resource. And again, we will include the link. Let me pause here to remind you that we want your questions. We now have it's not really that new, it's actually almost a year old, but Weekend Wisdom podcast that we are doing drops on, as you would imagine, the weekend. And we answer your questions. So please send us your questions. You can send them to info@creatingafamily.org, and it will find its way to me. And I will answer your questions on air, and we will not use your name if you don't choose for us to. So send us your questions, please, for our weekend wisdom. Keep in mind, I think it's important that we say this up front, what prospective adoptive parents see as a failure very well may be seen as a success by the biological parents. So we're talking about a failed match. And in no way am I trying to underplay the pain, and it is real, that prospective adoptive parents feel when that happens. I think it's important to also note that it's totally within the rights of the parents to make this decision. And for them, this is not a failure. This is, okay, I figured out ways to make this work type of thing. I also want to let you know about a terrific Creating a Family resource that we have. We did a survey. We have a very large online support group. It's a Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/creating a family. And we did a survey of our members of the group about how many faced an adoption match failure and how much money they lost, at what point in time during the pregnancy they were matched to see if there was a correlation there. We also interviewed a number of adoption attorneys and adoption agencies about what they're seeing. It's a really terrific resource. It's the only one I know of that really addresses this topic because it's not one that's talked about much. The title of that resource is Failed Adoption Matches, How Common, How Costly, and How to Survive. We also include in that tips for if you can look at your match, red flags that might indicate that the match may fail at some point. We will include the link to that resource in the show notes. So, Lila, when is the most common time for a mom to change her mind and decide to parent? Are there certain times? And does it matter when in the pregnancy she matches? You know, you can match, you know, it's possible, it doesn't happen very often, she can match at 8 weeks of pregnancy versus she can also match after the baby is born. So, you know, it's a long 9 month period. So when in that time is it most likely, or is there any common time?
I will say in my experience that I don't see a most common time, frankly. I do see perhaps a most common time depending on a circumstance of the birth mother. For instance, I find that when it's a young woman and this is her first pregnancy and she's not parenting other children, I think where I see the most likely time for her to change her mind is in the final stages of pregnancy when many women go through what they call the nesting period. You know, it's clearly an evolutionary part of our makeup when all the body signals are telling this woman to build the nest for the child. And I think when she starts feeling that, having never gone through that before, I think that can be a time when first-time mothers make that decision. Or immediately following the birth when she sees and holds the baby. And again, her body and her hormones are all telling her, this is your baby. So that, I think, for first-time mothers is a very common time. For women who have a fraught and on-again, off-again relationship with the biological father, what I look for is, how absent is he, or is he coming back around? Because that will have a huge impact on her decision, her final decision of whether mm-hmm. to surrender. Other than that, it's hard to predict. Very hard to predict.
You know, I would throw another one out there. If the birth grandmother, especially if it's the mom's mother, is not in favor of the adoption, the grandmother is often a major support. And if she is not in favor, yeah, I think you make an interesting point that the majority of women now who are making adoption plans are already parenting one or two or three children. So they have a very clear idea on what it is that they are getting into. All right. Do you see that it matters what stage of pregnancy the match was made?
I don't know that that is something I've observed, although I do think that the matches that come earlier in pregnancy give an opportunity for the prospective adoptive parents to build a relationship with the expectant mother. And that's what I tell my clients, is that that relationship, if you can build a relationship with her, and whoever her support system is, if the biological father is involved or the grandmother, if you can build a relationship during pregnancy, then that is going to go a long way to assuring her that you are someone that she can trust to raise her child and that she can trust to live into whatever degree of openness she has asked for.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is anxiety in these women. Very often there's anxiety that their child is not going to be raised well.
Sure, of course. Or that the adoptive parents will not honor the agreements that were made prior to the adoption. We asked that question about what trimester in the pregnancy or after birth they were matched to try to see if we could draw a correlation. And I was thinking when we did this that we would see if they were matched earlier in the pregnancy, it would be more likely because there would be more time for the match to fail. As you point out, we did not see that. Now, fewer women actually match in their first trimester, but actually we saw for matches that failed, the greatest number were in the third trimester. I don't know how scientific this is, but anyway, what you say about there doesn't seem to be a correlation seems to hold true from what we saw as well. Did you know that most people find out about podcasts through talking with others? Word of mouth is the number one way that people find out about podcasts. I know that to be true in my personal life. I do that all the time. I love podcasts. Of course, I love my own, but I also love other podcasts. And I'm always asking other podcast addicts, what are you listening to? So do us a favor. Our mission is to reach more and more people, and you are our top way of doing that. So please let your friends, let your family know about the Creating a Family podcast. It's super easy to subscribe on whatever app you are listening to a podcast on. Just search for Creating a Family and click the little subscribe or follow button. So tell your friends. Lila, how often do biological moms change their mind about making a placement for adoption where they decide against after they've already matched?
Well, of course, I don't have data on that beyond my own practice,
mm-hmm.
but I can say based on my observation and of my practice and my colleagues, I would guess that we're talking about 20 to 30%. These are people who've already hired a lawyer. So the match is far enough along that they need a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I see in my practice.
Yeah. And I think we have heard it's all over the board. I mean, from what we interviewed agencies, and 20 to 30%, we've seen 50%. So, you know, honestly, I would be a little worried if I was talking with an attorney or an agency and they say they don't see it at all. That would worry me. Because that's just both not realistic, but also would make me worry that there's some form of coercion or something that could be going on with the expectant parents. So, yeah.
I would agree with that. But what I would also suggest is that if you are working with a truly skilled professional, whether it's an agency or an independent social worker or an attorney who's also highly ethical, it's also possible that there could be really good screening at the front end so that perhaps
valid point.
Prospective adoptive parents would be introduced to a pregnant woman, but the professionals are saying this one very well won't work out. So you go into it knowing there's a high degree of risk and then indeed quickly it fails. I hesitate to even call those failed matches because I've had clients go through that and it's still frustrating and disappointing and saddening, but because they've been careful at the front end with a good assessment of that woman and where she is in her decision-making process and where the risks are, they can protect themselves from getting too far into that match so that it is a devastating failure.
Yeah, and adoption matches which fail are both emotionally really, really hard. Falls into the category of we talk about ambiguous loss. I mean, no one understands it. It's your loss, but this is actually, you know, this is a not a loss for this woman who you've formed a relationship with. It's just very confusing and people don't get it. So you're kind of alone in this loss. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But before we talk about some of the coping with it parts, it's not only the emotional aspect, but it can also be a financial hit. And that's something that I think a lot of parents don't realize. And I think that we in the field need to be more clear with families. So let's talk about that. How can an adoptive parent lose money if the match fails?
Well, I want to say, first of all, I don't want to think about it as losing money. There are costs for services at every step of the way. And it is so important that you engage skilled and ethical professionals along the way to make sure that the adoption plan is well formulated and that everyone is supported. And so at the beginning of the match, the adoptive parents need to be paying someone to do a thorough assessment of that pregnant woman. And so that money is being spent for services and it doesn't come back. You don't get a refund if the adoption doesn't go forward, but you've paid for something of real value. You need to hire a lawyer to assess the legal issues of each state. If the match fails, that money does not get refunded to you. You paid for that. You had valuable services provided to you. Now, there are many agencies and some facilitators where you are paying for the match. You are paying to be introduced to that woman. That money, depending on your agreement with that person, some of that could be refunded if the match fails. And you need to scrutinize that and consider that very carefully in advance before you pay that money and ask those questions and look at whatever contract you're signing with the agency or the facilitator to say, when am I entitled to a refund or perhaps, you know, some discount on future services if a match fails?
Well, and I appreciate what you're saying. You're paying for services, so you're not losing money. On the other hand, if you're a prospective adoptive parent who is going into their savings or they have got a home equity loan and they've got X amount of money to spend and they're spending it with the hope of becoming a parent, to them it very much feels like a loss.
Absolutely.
Some agencies have a common pool where if money is lost, each family has contributed to that, so it does not impact the individual parents, do not have to pay. So that's part of it. Another thing to consider is expectant mom expenses that you may have been paying the mom, maybe perhaps her rent or a food allowance or whatever it is, depending on the state. You have certain things that you can reimburse the mom. Maternity clothes is often included in that. That also doesn't come back. It's not a quid pro quo. I pay this and then you give me your baby. That's just not how it works. In our survey, just to give people an idea, we asked, how much money did you lose on the failed match? And these were our results. 17 people said they lost no money. 9 people said that they lost less than $1,000. 17 people reported that they were out between $1,000 and $5,000, and then 16 said that they lost more than $5,000. And not everyone shared an amount, but those that did, they ranged from the $10,000, $9,000, all the way up to $15,000, $16,000, and $30,000.
And that absolutely can be devastating. You know, what I hope for people seeking an adoption is that they are doing lots of research, and I'm sure creating a family has lots of resources on financial planning and budgeting, and also the applicability of the federal adoption tax credit, because it can be utilized in some cases for the expenses of a failed adoption.
Yes, it can.
And so I'm hoping that hopeful adoptive parents are researching that and incorporating that into their budget planning.
We have an annual show on the adoption tax credit. And every time we talk about how you recoup your money if you have a failed match. And that's a very valuable resource. Now let's talk about how adoptive parents can cope when an adoption match falls apart. As I mentioned, it's a weird type of grief. It is a grief. I mean, there's just no question. Even if you know, and of course, intellectually, you may well know that this baby is not yours. This baby during this pregnancy belongs to its mom. And you know that intellectually, but you cannot help but start becoming attached. Start envisioning. You may be having a baby shower. You may be decorating a nursery. And even if you hold off doing all those things, I don't know a single person who's not saying, okay, the due date is in May. Okay, so gosh, if we're going to have a baby moon, we better plan it in April. Or, you know, family, everybody is going to be coming in the summer here. So you start shifting your life to make room for and nesting is real for adoptive parents too. And you're going through all this. And then it feels like the rug is ripped out from under you. There's just nothing other than grief to describe it.
I agree.
Hard. Yeah.
And the other thing that happens and that we see in my observation, the majority of women making the decision to place a child for adoption are struggling financially. And they also may be struggling with depression or other mental illnesses, and they may be struggling with substance problems and relationship problems. And when those women make the decision to parent, it is also very difficult for these prospective adoptive parents, these people who did attach to the idea, the knowledge that a baby is growing and they were hoping that baby was going to come home with them. And then to know that that baby is going to be raised by a woman who faces a lot of challenges, that causes so many conflicting feelings about worrying about the baby.
Mm-hmm. And anger sometimes, you know, the feeling, and it's not something you want to talk about because you're just going to hear, well, it wasn't your baby. So, but anger, I would be a better parent. You know, I have more resources, whatever, just a whole very conflicting feelings.
Yeah.
So what do you suggest to prospective adoptive parents going through this?
You know, I suggest therapy. I try to remind them that I'm not a therapist, even though I'm here to listen and process feelings along with them, that I encourage them to get counseling. You know, a good home study provider is also qualified in many instances to provide counseling. And so I encourage people to choose their home study provider, to choose someone who has the experience and the licensing to provide actual counseling services. That can be wonderful to work through these issues with someone who's very experienced in adoption, and also to seek support from peers. I follow the Creating a Family Facebook groups just to hear what's going on so that I can better relate to my clients. And getting that peer support through a Facebook group or a local support group. Many mm-hmm. areas have local support groups for people trying to build a family.
Mm-hmm. And some agencies have this as well. Yeah. I will also throw out that in that survey that we did, I think all or certainly almost all of the people who responded were able to adopt successfully after a failed match. Now, we had a skewed audience in that they were members of our support group. So if they had dropped out of the adoption process, they probably would have dropped out of the group. But nonetheless, I think all of them were able to, or there were a few that were still in the process, but they expected to be successful. So hopefully that will help as well. Let me interrupt this interview just to remind you that the Jockey Being Family Foundation, who has been a very long-term supporter of our mission here at Creating a Family and this podcast, they have provided the funding for us to offer free courses for you. You can check those courses out at bit.ly/JBF support. There are 12 courses. They change annually. If you needed certificates of completion, you can get them. But if you don't need it, you can still listen to the courses. They are terrific. So check them out at bit.ly/JBF support. All right. Up to this point, we've been talking about domestic infant adoption. But I also want to talk about matches when you are adopting through foster care. And it is an entirely different process. So match means a different thing in foster care. Do you want to take a stab at talking about that first, Lila?
Sure. So as you say, it's foster care adoptions are very different, but typically the path to adoption of a foster child either is entering the system and telling your state agency, child welfare agency, in Georgia we call it DFACS, telling them, we are signing up and want to adopt a child who is already available for adoption. So a child where parental rights have already been terminated. Or you enter the system and agree to foster children who are not available for adoption, with the understanding and certainly hope that if those children are not able to be reunified with their families, their biological families, that then you would want to adopt those children. Obviously, that path carries the potential for a lot more heartbreak, because many of those children are eventually going to be reunified with their birth parents or with biological relatives.
Mm-hmm. About three quarters, and it's been remained the same for many years. What we say is that you need to go in with the full understanding that you are likely going to be a temporary soft landing place for this child, and that you take on the responsibility to root for the birth family, mm-hmm. to support reunification. That is the goal. But about 25% of the time, reunification, either with the biological parents or with extended family, doesn't happen. Right. And most often, foster parents are then asked if they would like to step forward. So I'm so glad you pointed that out.
Yeah. But aside from the reunification piece of it, that what feels like a match mm-hmm. could fail because a child is sent to a relative or back to the parents. Aside from that, putting that aside, there also are instances where the match itself, the relationship between these hopeful parents and the child, doesn't work. These are children without exception who have come from trauma, and trauma damages children. And the result is often behaviors that are difficult to deal with and a whole variety of issues. And there are times when those prospective adoptive parents and the agency need to make the decision, this is not the right match. Mm-hmm. And that can be very hard, because that child is already in your home and you feel responsibility, you feel guilt if you have mm-hmm. to make the decision that you are not the right parent for this child. And that can be really, really hard. And what I say to people when I counsel them during a time like that is that, as hard as that is to make that decision, the only thing worse for the child than having to then change homes again before adoption is when the relationship truly falls apart after the adoption is finalized.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly right. And sometimes it's not just the parents, but in fact, very often we see that if other children in the family are struggling with this placement, that's a strong indicator that it may not be a good match for the family.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, but it's hard. What about an international adoption?
So, of course, I'm sure many of your listeners are aware that the number of international adoption opportunities has decreased significantly over the years as laws have changed and with political changes as well. But in most instances, I would say all that I'm aware of, the termination of parental rights happens in the child's home country. And in most cases, the adoption itself is finalized in the child's home country. But there are still failures, I guess, at adoption matches that don't proceed to finalization along the way for different reasons. And it can be painful, and it's still all the same things that we talked about with a birth mother making the decision. There's heartbreak and anxiety and anger and loss of money along the way as you're pursuing that adoption, and something goes wrong in that country or with that child or with that system where you're not able to finally bring that child home.
Mm-hmm. It's not common, but we do see it happening even after the families have traveled and are in country. They realize that this child's needs are greater than we can meet, or for whatever reason. And that's even more complicated, of course, because they're already in the child's country.
Mm-hmm.
So it is possible for the match in international adoption to fail. And before we leave, let's talk about adoptions that disrupt, fail, after the adoption is finalized. That is not what we have been talking about up to this point. Up to this point, we've been talking about before the adoption is finalized, the match fails. But sadly, adoption, and the terms are all over the place. Adoption dissolution, I think, is the official term, but you also hear it called adoption disruption. Let's talk briefly about those failures and how they differ.
Yeah, so when an adoption is finalized in a court, in a state court, and the judge signs that order of adoption, under the law, and this is the law to the best of my knowledge in all 50 states plus territories, that child is legally the child of the adoptive parents, and the legal relationship between those adoptive parents and the child is identical to the legal relationship between people who gave birth to their children. And so in the state of Georgia, there is no path to dissolving an adoption relationship, a legal adoption. There is no path to undo an adoption. And so for those tragic cases where the adoptive parents at some point struggle with the ability to parent the child, and I would say, in my experience, that's most often we're talking about children who came from the foster care system, or in international adoptions, they're still coming from a foster care system, from a child welfare system. It was just in that other country. Those children were harmed by the trauma, and then the behaviors and disorders that they develop, the adoptive parents come to the point where they say, I can't parent this child anymore. What do I do?
Mm-hmm.
And if they call me as an attorney in Georgia, I tell them there is no path to undoing this adoption other than finding a new home for this child and working through the legal process of placing this child for another adoption. I am aware that there are some courts around the country that, depending on some particularly critical and tragic facts, might be willing to undo an adoption or dissolve it, but that is the minority of the cases. In most cases, there's no legal path to undo the adoption. It has to be a secondary placement for adoption.
In essence, you become the not expectant, but you become the parent who is making an adoption plan for this child.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Lila Bradley, for talking with us today about predicting and coping with failed adoption matches. We truly appreciate your expertise.
Well, I enjoyed the opportunity, and I wish all your listeners the best in their search.
Before you leave, don't click off yet on the podcast. I wanted to tell you about a new training that we are offering, a prenatal substance exposure to alcohol and drug training that we are offering. I don't know that we have ever created anything I am more proud of. It is such a good, it's an interactive training. It is a facilitated interactive training. There's lots of small groups. There's working through scenarios. It is three sessions. It is just an excellent, excellent training. So if you think that any of the children you are parenting may have been exposed to alcohol or drugs and you are confused by some of their behaviors or learning challenges, please check it out at bit.ly/prenatal-exposure-training. That's bit.ly/prenatal-exposure-training.